Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. We are examining the Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 27, the shorter discourse on the simile of the elephant's footprint. And in this sutta, the Buddha is explaining to a Brahmin Chanu Soni, how a particular simile of tracking the elephant by its footprint is to be correctly understood. And he does this by developing a schematism of the gradual training, the step-by-step training of the entire path to liberation. And this is the training for those who have entered upon the homeless life and are ready to pursue that training with full earnestness all the way to its final stages. And so far, I have been explaining what I call the preconditions for the gradual training. That is the arising of the Buddha in the world and his teaching of the Dhamma. Then a layperson hears the Dhamma and acquires faith. Possessing that faith, the person goes forth into homelessness. And as the second major step, after going forth, undertakes the training in sila, or moral restraint. And so far I have covered the aspect of sila dealing with relating to right bodily action, the training relating to right speech, and then various minor principles of moral training in which the main emphasis is on the right livelihood. Okay, now we continue on page 274 of the text, paragraph 14. This is a section dealing with a virtue known as contentment. In Pali, santosa, or also known as santuti. Does the word santosa seem familiar? Does it connect with another word that you might be familiar with? You might have seen before? If you take away the prefix, S-A-N, just take the main part, tosa. Sure, you've all, when I mention the word, you'll all say, oh. I'll give you a hint. I don't want to give the hint since it's such a giveaway once I mention the hint. Where is Maitreya Buddha? Tusita heaven. Tusita means the heaven of the contented. So it's from the same root, tus, which means contentment. Santusa, that's just a form with a prefix. So this is being content. And so now the Buddha is describing the way a monk who's living this dedicated life is content with the barest, simplest requisites of life. He's content simply with robes to protect his body and with alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out taking only these with him. Actually, when he sets out, he doesn't really take the alms food with him, but he takes the alms bowl with him. So what he possesses, his basic possessions, are just the robes. This would be a set of three robes with, there's a belt, a bathing cloth, alms bowl, a few other simple requisites, maybe some soap, toothbrush, toothpaste, a little towel. And wherever he goes, that's all he needs, maybe a pair of sandals. If he could even go without sandals, if he's living a life of walking, sandals are more a burden than a help. So he's living in India or Southeast Asia, where it's a hot climate, doesn't need sandals. So just like a bird, wherever it goes with its wings as its only burden. It doesn't need anything more but its wings. It travels with its wings. So the monk, he's content with the robes to protect his body and to taking the alms bowl, to go collecting alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he takes these with him. Often he has no fixed sense of direction, but he wanders wherever the road leads. I remember in Sri Lanka, there's a German monk still alive today. I think he must be about 90 years old, who lived a very austere ascetic life from 1964 until about 1987, when he became too weak to continue this way of life because of a hip ailment. Except for the 3 months of the rainy season, the rest of the year he would always walk without any fixed residence. If he found a nice place for meditation, then he would stay there for a few weeks, a month, and then just continue walking. So that he had walked over the whole island of Sri Lanka many times. He would just go anywhere he wanted. I remember one time he was in Colombo. He would come from time to time if he needed some medical treatment. Then when he left, he would have his bag with him. And some man had seen him leaving the monastery where he was staying, walking towards the corner. And the man had asked him, "Ah, Venerable Sir, where are you going?" He knew that he was leaving the monastery to continue his walking tour. He said, "I haven't decided yet. When I get to the corner, I'll decide." Okay, so living this very simple life of contentment, he maintains himself just with the robes, the bowl. Okay, now all of these things taken together, all of these constitute what is called the aggregate of noble virtue, the Arya Sila Khanda. And so possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, where here I have the noble aggregate of virtue, he experiences within himself a bliss that is blameless. This is called in Pali is called anavajja sukha. It could be also understood as the bliss of blamelessness. Because one is living a very pure life, a life based upon right action, right speech, right livelihood, a life of simplicity, contentment. This life of purity, pure moral restraint, impacts upon the mind and creates a kind of pure bliss and happiness in the mind. So one experiences a joy of knowing that one is leading a blameless life. And this happiness swells up and envelops the mind, uplifts the mind of the practitioner. But this is still a relatively basic type of spiritual happiness. Because the training and moral discipline is still concerned primarily with the disciplining of outer modes of action. It's mainly concerned with the control of bodily action, speech, and livelihood. But when one is training bodily action, speech, and livelihood, what one is really training is the mind. One is training the mind to restrain those types of actions, those impulses, those volitions, those tendencies which break out in the form of unwholesome bodily action, speech, and wrong modes of livelihood. One is controlling the impulses of demandingness, of grasping, of discontent, not being content with what one has. One is trying to develop patience. To practice contentment, one has to be patient. When one is subsisting by begging with the alms bowl, some days one will get nothing or very little. And one has to be patient, endure until the next day. Sometimes one will get food which doesn't agree with one, and so one will have to eat it anyway and be content with it. And so one is developing such qualities as patience, humility, simplicity, endurance, and all of these are building up within the mind. And as they build up, they are expelling the unwholesome tendencies and creating this strength, this power of inner virtue. And this is this virtues that are building up within the mind are bringing along this accompanying bliss, this bliss of blamelessness, this bliss of being free from faults, from flaws in one's conduct. But now, with the next step, the training becomes more and more internalized. Now the training is moving from the outward towards the inward. And this next stage in the training is called the training in sense restraint. We have the six or five physical sense faculties, eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body, and then the mind faculty. And each of these sense faculties has its own corresponding object. The eye has forms, the ear has sounds, nose smells, the tongue has taste, the body has tactile objects. Then the mind faculty, the mental faculty, can take as object the objects of all the five physical sense faculties, and also it has its own objects. Images, abstract concepts, ideas, and so on. And these sense faculties are constantly being impinged upon by sense objects. And when we don't guard the sense faculties, then the objects that impinge on the senses go through the senses and come to the mind. And when they impact on the mind, when we're not being vigilant and mindful, then they arouse, they generate unwholesome states of mind. And if the Buddha could speak about this 2,500 years ago in India, then what he was saying then is so much more pertinent to the situation today when we have television, internet, on the computer, cinema. People still watch cinemas. television and some of the other things. I'm afraid to mention things because... Excuse me? Malls, shopping malls. And they have these things, they used to call them video cassettes. VHS. They still do. DVDs, that's what it was. Okay, so all the sense enjoyments you want, you just have to call, make a telephone call, or drive out in your car to the shop, and you get it all. Okay, and now the Buddha is dealing, when he's training monks, these are often 18-year-old boys who have just come off the farm, so to speak, just come off the householder's sons. They've just come off the farms, out of the towns, young men, early 20s, nuns, good young women from good households, late teens, early 20s. So these are people in the prime of life. In fact, there's a sutta, comes in the Samyutta Nikaya, where there's a King Udaina, it is. He's speaking to a monk named Pindola Bharadvaja, and he's amazed and perplexed how the Buddhist monks who are, he uses the expression, these are young men in the prime of life, black-haired lads endowed with the blessing of youth, yet they're able to sustain the pure spiritual life for their whole life. How are they able to do so? He asks. And one of the answers is that they practice this restraint of the senses. And this is given, there's a stock formula, on seeing a form with the eye, he does not grasp at its signs and features. Here, two terms are used, signs and features. Can everybody see this? Okay, now what happens when a sense, usually attractive sense object, impinges on the senses. Can you see? First, one gets the general impression. That is the nimitta. Nimitta. So, particularly the most provocative sense object is usually it's a sexually interesting object. So the young monk sees a pretty girl and it's the image is, ah, pretty girl. That's the nimitta. The general impression, translated as sign. Sort of like the signal or indicator, the nature of the object. Then anubhyanjana are the details. So if one isn't exercising restraint, then the eye will start wandering, very beautiful smile, nice twinkly eyes, lovely hands. So one starts noticing the details with the eye and the ear. Ah, nice sweet voice. Or it could be in the opposite way. There could be somebody that one has some negative feeling towards. That person enters the room, you see the person, then there comes sort of the grasping of the general impression, ah, that hostile person has come in. And so one just gets the general impression, kind of negative vibration swells into the mind, the appearance of that person. Then there comes the anubhyanjana gahi, the grasping of the details. The way the person walks is annoying. The way the person comes in and sits down is annoying. The way the person gets up and starts fiddling around is annoying. The sound of the person's voice is rasping to the ear. Everything is disturbing about that person. Sometimes if one is walking in the street, well, this is an experience that I've gone through walking in the streets as a Buddhist monk. People, they don't do it so much, but earlier I used to get like people yelling words of ridicule. Generally, not people walking in the streets, but people riding by in cars sometimes would call out things. So the way I used to practice would be when walking on busy streets, never to look up when anybody would be calling out from cars, but always just to, if I hear anybody calling from a car, just to keep my eyes focused ahead of me. But one time, I was still living in Sri Lanka, but I was visiting my parents, and I went for a walk on a busy street, Nassau Boulevard. It's a busy street that goes through West Hempstead, and I was walking along, and then a car was coming by and slowing down alongside me, and I thought, okay, just keep your attention on your feet, keep your attention on your feet, don't look up. The car was slowing down, okay, trouble is coming. Just kept my attention on my feet. It kept going alongside. Finally, the car stopped. I thought, uh-oh. Okay, practice patience, loving kindness. Then I saw the corner of my eye, I saw a man walking towards me. I said, okay, get up all your loving kindness. I looked up, and it was looked like an Asiatic man, an Asian man. He said, excuse me, venerable sir. Are you going someplace? May I offer you a ride? So this is the practice of sense restraint. One does not grasp at the signs, that's the general impression, or the features that is at the details. The reason is that if one left the eye faculty unguarded, that's if one left it unrestrained, then here it's called evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. It's translated very literally, but what is actually meant by covetousness here would be states of desire, greed, lust, attachment, craving. And by grief, I'm not sure that grief is a good translation. I think actually grief is not a good translation. In fact, I've changed my translation of this word, dominasa. It's better translated dejection, unhappiness. So these are basically the two responses to pleasant stimulation will tend to arouse desire or craving, and unpleasant stimulation will arouse dejection or aversion. And so the practitioner, the bhikkhu, the monk, the meditator, practices restraint of the eye. He guards the eye faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the eye faculty. And when the text speaks about restraint of the eye faculty, what is really being restrained here? What is it being restrained? It's really the mind. Because one doesn't really restrain the eye itself. The eye naturally sees forms. That's the nature of the eye. In fact, there is a sutta that comes at the end of the Majjhima Nikaya where the Buddha hears about one Brahmin who teaches a type of sense restraint, whose teaching on sense restraint is don't see any forms with the eye, don't hear any sounds with the ear. But if that's the ideal practice of sense restraint, he says, then blind and deaf people would be spiritually advanced. But rather, the practice of sense restraint is restraining the mind when the senses make contact with their objects. And what is it that enables one to exercise restraint of the mind, particular mental function? What is it? I heard it, but not loud enough. Speak up. Mindfulness, right? It's mindfulness, sati, that enables one to be aware of one's state of mind, and through awareness of one's state of mind, then one is able to use energy or effort to restrain these states, unwholesome states of mind, when they're tending to arise, and to keep them under control. And so the same practice applies to each of the sense faculties. Ear, nose, tongue, body faculty, and then the mind faculty with regard to its own objects. All of the images that arise, fantasies, ideas, speculations, streams of thought. In regard to these, one has to exercise restraint of the mind faculty. And generally, as the monk is practicing in this way, almost invariably, he's not just practicing out of the blue, but he'll have a basic meditation object to keep his mind focused on and to be returning to as a kind of anchor point for the mind, even when in the midst of activity. So we could assume that maybe the beginner will be trained in mindfulness of breathing, and so having some experience in learning to train the mind and to keep the mind focused on an object, then when one goes into the midst of activity, becoming engaged with sensory objects, one will know how to withdraw the mind from these objects and return it to the breath when necessary, even pausing in the midst of activity just to bring the mind back to the in and out breathing, just maybe for a few seconds, a minute, before resuming one's activities. Okay, from restraint of the sense faculties, now the faculty of mindfulness is being strengthened. The faculty of energy is being strengthened. And all of this is bringing about an increasing purification of the mind. So possessing this noble restraint of the faculties, now the monk, the practitioner, experiences within himself what is called a bliss that is unsullied, unadulterated, uncorrupted. Now that bliss by observing the precepts, by following the moral discipline, he experienced the bliss, a bliss that is blameless. Now that bliss is becoming stronger, more powerful, becomes called a bliss that is unsullied, uncorrupted, untainted, because of the restraint of the sense faculties. And now the next section introduces the practice of what is called, here it's translated full awareness, but I now prefer another translation, clear comprehension. The Pali word is sampajanya. Okay, the abstract noun is called sampajanya. That would be clear comprehension. And acting with clear comprehension or full awareness is sampajanakari. And the word comes from, the root is nya, which means to know. And it has two prefixes. Pa, which has a sense of, hard to give, directness, yeah. Pa has a sense of directness, and sam has a sense of fullness. From pa plus nya, one gets panya, in Sanskrit, prajna. It would be wisdom. But sampajanya is not quite the same as wisdom. It's related to it, and it's, you might say, it's a seed out of which wisdom develops. But wisdom is a higher quality, a deeper quality than sampajanya. Sampajanya is more the quality of observation, an observation, let's call it a judicious observation, circumspection perhaps. Now the text generally uses a stock formula for sampajanya, but the commentaries come in quite useful in explaining different aspects of sampajanya. And they explain four different aspects of this full awareness or clear comprehension. The four aspects, one is called clear comprehension of purpose, which means that before one acts, before one does anything, one pauses momentarily to fix in one's mind, to clarify in one's mind the purpose of one's action, so that one doesn't act impulsively. One doesn't act irrationally. One doesn't act just automatically in the force of blind habit. But one clarifies what is the purpose. One clarifies to oneself, what is the purpose? Why am I doing this? And as one trains in this discipline of clear comprehension, then one's ability to apply the clarification of one's purpose to one's actions becomes applied to more and more minute actions, so that actions that are quite ordinarily done habitually will now be done purposefully. To illustrate this, there's one story that comes, I think, in a commentary, a Pali commentary, that there was a monk, an elder monk, who was having a discussion with some other monks, and he had lifted up his arm in the discussion, then he had put his arm back down, then lifted up the arm again. The other monk stopped and they said, "Venerable sir, why did you just lift up your arm the second time in the same way?" Then he said, "Well, I've been trying to practice consistently clear comprehension of purpose. And when I lifted up the arm the first time, I did it without clear comprehension. So I put the arm back in the same position, and then I lifted it up again, this time clearly aware of my purpose." Okay, so, yeah. Excuse me? Does it have any? Yeah. Okay, that's a good question. Mindfulness is sati. And mindfulness works very closely in very close association with clear comprehension. So often they're described almost as a pair. So we have mindfulness and clear comprehension. So mindfulness, we could say, is an aware. These words get very difficult to differentiate. Okay, mindfulness is an awareness, a basic awareness, say, of what one is doing. Sampajanya is knowing, in this case, the purpose of what one is doing. So in this case, say, I'm going to pick up the chalk to write. Clear sampajanya, clear comprehension. I know that I'm picking up the chalk in order to write, mindfulness is being aware that I'm taking up the piece of chalk, picking it up, and then going to the blackboard with it. Again, all of these words, I would say attention is closer to mindfulness than to clear. Intention. I'd say intention, I would say Sampajanya understands the intention, but the intention is distinct from the clear comprehension itself. Clear comprehension would be the knowing of the intention. Maybe to give another example that might make the meaning, bring out the meaning, there's an expression, Sampajana Musavada, which is, could be translated, clearly comprehending that one is telling a lie. telling a deliberate lie. So Sampajana, one knows, one is clearly comprehending, clearly knows, but one is speaking a lie. Here, there's an intention to deceive. That is what motivates the lie. But one is aware that one is doing it. That is the clear comprehension. But that's an unwholesome type. Okay, but let me continue now. Okay, so there's the first type, clear comprehension of purpose. Second type, is called clear comprehension of the means. This is clear comprehension of the most suitable means for achieving one's purpose. So having determined one's purpose, one will then consider how one could achieve one's purpose most effectively. And then one will comprehend what is the means to achieve one's purpose. And the third type, the meaning is a little obscure. It's called Gotara Sampajanya. It continues with the word on Sampajanya, Gotara Sampajanya. Now the word Gotara literally means pasture or domain. The Gotara is the place where cattle graze. So it's the domain in which, taken figuratively, where a practitioner grazes. And this is taken to mean the object of meditation. And so the sense is that the practitioner, whenever engaged in activities that don't require the attention to be deflected outwardly, will draw his attention back into the meditation object and keep that object clearly in mind. And so if, say, the meditator is practicing mindfulness of breathing, if one is walking down the street, it's difficult to be aware of the breath in a very subtle way, but one might try to be aware of the rhythm of breathing in the body. It'll be difficult to be aware of the breath at the tip of the nostrils, but one could try to be aware of the breathing breath in the lungs. Or if one doesn't want to focus upon such a fine object, when just walking, one will try to be aware just of the movements of the body and walking, keeping the mind in this meditative frame, not letting the mind drift and get swept away by streams of stray thoughts, but keeping the mind drawn inward and fixed, steady upon its meditation object, and keeping the mind being clearly aware of the meditation object, and clearly aware when the mind, when one has to let the meditation object, when one has to put the main meditation object down to engage in other activities, and when one will be able to pick up the meditation object and continue to attend to it. Then the fourth type of clear comprehension is called clear comprehension of non-delusion. And this is the point where clear comprehension evolves into panya or prajna. Now this is the clear comprehension which is being exercised within the framework of insight meditation. This is the clear comprehension that one is practicing when one is developing, say, the four foundations of mindfulness, when one is contemplating the body, feelings, states of mind, and mental objects. And as one is comprehending, clearly comprehending these four foundations of mindfulness, then that clear comprehension is starting to peel away the layers of delusion or ignorance that cover up the nature of the body and the mind. And as one is peeling away those layers of delusion, of ignorance, then the true nature of the bodily and mental phenomena is coming into the open. And when it comes into the open, when the true nature is fully exposed, then one is penetrating it with wisdom directly. And that is panya, prajna. Is there any question about these four types of clear comprehension? No, in fact, I'm going to come to this. Yeah. They're sort of anticipating. Maybe I should have got. I just wanted to ask if there are any questions about the four types before I come back to paragraph 16. Yeah.
In the translation of the 14, it talks of lives with its wings as its own burden.
Yeah.
Why would it be considered a burden if that was only the means of going?
It's just a manner of expression, just because, just the things that it has to take with it, that's all. Yeah. Okay, so let me then take paragraph 16. What I was going to say is that in the practice of clear comprehension or full awareness described here, it's really the first two of the four that are most prominent here. Clear comprehension of purpose and clear comprehension of the most suitable means. And so the monk is described as one who acts in full awareness or with clear comprehension when going forward, when going out someplace, when returning. Because now he's mindful of even of all the activities of the mind, so when he has to look up, he's aware of the purpose of looking up. It's not one whose eyes just roam and wander around, but the eyes are usually just, they say, cast down, just a yard or two in front. And when there's some purpose to look up, when we'll look up mindfully, aware of the purpose. And if there's some reason to look to the side, when we'll look to the side. And then when there's no more purpose in looking up or looking aside, again, the eyes go just a yard, 2 yards ahead. One acts in full awareness when bending and when extending or bending in the arms. One acts in full awareness when wearing the robes and carrying the outer robe and bowl. One acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting. And if one practices this, then no danger of consuming too much food and gaining excess weight. Because one, it's true. No, it's not, I'm not joking. It's very true. No one eats and one knows exactly when one has had the right amount. And when one reaches that point, then one just naturally stops. Just one has no need to go on noshing. Is that the word? Is that it? Munching. But I remember noshing. Is that the word that's used? Excuse me? It is. Noshing. I have to relearn my American English. Is it Yiddish? Well, I have to relearn that. And the reason why there's a distinction between eating and consuming food, because, I don't know, for some reason the Indians decided to give one word for eating things like grains, meat, fish, are put in one category, then vegetables, fruits, nuts, all other foods in another category. So one thing is called eating, the other thing is called consuming. Then tasting is just, you want to taste this, let me have a taste of that. Okay, even when going to the toilet, one acts with clear comprehension, one acts in full awareness when walking, these are just small movements, walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. And again, when one acts with clear comprehension, little danger of disturbing the mind, stirring up the mind with excessive talking. Of course, one will know the purpose of talking. And when this purpose is served, then one will keep silent. But of course, in ordinary life, one has to talk to people, otherwise people will think one is being unfriendly. Okay, I think now we've reached a suitable point for cutting off. And then we're getting closer and closer to the elephant. But I leave for next week the point where we really start to see the elephant, to see the elephant's footprint. Next time we'll see the elephant's footprint. Now, any questions? Yeah. The emphasis in this paragraph is on the first two.
First two.
Yeah. Clear comprehension of
purpose,
clear comprehension of the suitability, suitable means. But though the emphasis is on those two, the other two could come in for, say, a very accomplished practitioner. But we won't go into that, because now we're still in the stages of a gradual training. Any Any further questions? Yeah. Suki. Yeah. I don't want to go into this now because that really is beyond the subject matter of the sutta, of the portion of the sutta that I'm discussing. Yeah. I just want to really stick to questions that pertain to the subject matter. Yeah, this is a kind of training. It doesn't mean that at this point that he's perfectly content, that the mind is not bubbling with thoughts of discontent. But at this point, he's living and sustaining himself just with these basic, very simple requisites. That's a good way to express it, yeah. Though, supposing that this is an ordinary person, say, with good qualities, there'll be times when he'll be experiencing great happiness and peace, say, just living with these basic requisites, thinking how free I am from the burden of material possessions. Now I have just nothing to worry about, no anxious concern over maintaining a house, property, no insurance for my car. But then there will come times maybe when thinking, how could I have given up all of those wonderful joys and pleasures just to be wearing bare robes and just to be having to wander from house to house, times missing good meals. Those thoughts might come, but then he'll train himself to subdue those thoughts, and then by that training gradually becomes content with this way of life. Yeah. That will be a function of sampajanya, of knowing the breath going in and out. That is a sampajanya. That would be a type of what we call gochara sampajanya, clear comprehension of the object. But being aware of the object, say the, again, it's somewhat difficult to distinguish, differentiate these states. The awareness of the object, here's the problem, because he translates sampajanya by awareness, but I like to use or to identify awareness with mindfulness. So I say that the awareness, the observation, the attention is the mindfulness, and the knowing of the breath going in and out is sampajanya. If you look at the mind, you could, with very subtle attention, you can distinguish those two factors, those two elements. The bare awareness of the breath going in and out, and the knowing of it going in and out. The bare awareness is the mindfulness. The actual knowing is sampajanya, clear comprehension. Any other questions? Okay, then we stop. Okay, we dedicate the merits. There's a little... First, we dedicate the merit to the deities and the dragon spirits, the Nagas, asking them to rejoice in the merits and protect for a long time the Buddha's teaching, then to protect for a long time the preaching or exposition of the teaching, then to protect for a long time ourselves and others. Then, with the next three verses, we ask first the devas, the deities, to rejoice in the merit of teaching and listening to the Dharma, and we ask them by rejoicing to achieve all success. Then we ask the Buddhas, these are the harmful spirits, We ask them to rejoice in the merits and achieve all success. Then we invite all beings to rejoice in the merits and achieve all success. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanang Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanang Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mang Parang Etavata Cha Amhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Deva Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavata Cha Amhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Bhuta Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya